Hi, everyone. Good morning and welcome to Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, and today I'm joined by the amazing Rick Rehan coming to us from Tokyo. Thanks so much for joining.
Look, it's a pleasure. It's great to see you again. It's been a minute, hasn't it?
It has. So Rick, you were one of the first guests I think I had on the show when I was first getting started, talking about your amazing company, Image Mill. Can you just catch us up? Like, what is Image Mill? What's your philosophy for business?
Sure. Yeah, it's been a while. So Image Mill, we've been going 12 years in Japan, but originally started in Ireland back, it's like a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago. And, you know, I've been around the world. I've worked in London briefly, and then I worked in South Africa in advertising and communications. And it was there that I realized that advertising didn't really suit me so much. You know, I was working with a lot of big companies that, you know, in my daytime work, I was actually boycotting due to their kind of unethical practices. You know, at the time I just thought it was shogunai. You know, you got to kind of earn your money, and then in your spare time you can do something with meaning or purpose. So it was back then that I realized, yeah, I needed to get out of advertising. And so I ran away. I've told you this before, but I was in India, and it was there that I realized that there's nothing wrong with advertising or communications or branding. It's just, you know, if it has a purpose, you know, it's the intention and the meaning behind it. And with, you know, with those kind of tools of helping to convince people, you know, to do things, they can do good instead. So anyway, so I moved to Japan, worked briefly in advertising here, and then founded Image Mill to be kind of the first sustainable ethical branding agency. And it wasn't easy, you know, at the time. It was, you know, this 12 years ago, and there was still talk about sustainability, but Japan was a little bit behind the curve. So it took some time to get to now. And now Image Mill, we're quite well strategically placed to help companies find their purpose and then express that in truthful ways. You know, we call it branded journalism. And but so it's not like branded content, it's journalism. So yes, you know, we're helping a brand to, you know, sell and to, you know, be successful, but at the same time, you know, participate in the community and society in a good way.
And you're walking the talk, right? Like, you are a 1% back to the planet and B Corp company. And then this new project, Satoyama, that we're talking about today, is really showing how you can put to use a lot of the things that you're talking about. How do we find a way to balance the needs of people and planet with making profits and the center regenerative? I see that you're using more regenerative as the word. We got to go beyond sustainability. We got to do better. We got to revive what's been neglected, right?
Yeah, I just got a little bit fed up with the word sustainability. You know, it's been going around a long time, and, you know, it's been hijacked in many ways. And just the whole philosophy behind it, you know, it's all about reducing your negative impact, you know, trying to reduce your carbon levels, you know, trying not to pollute as much, you know, and it's more about refining processes and becoming, you know, doing things in a better way, which is great. But, you know, I think we need to go beyond that and think more about regeneration. And that's by doing business, you're creating a positive impact, you know, and that's whether it's with the society you're working with or the environment. And there's a few amazing brands out there that are walking the walk. You know, I always come back to Patagonia, you know, who are kind of legends in my mind, you know, and they kind of helped develop the idea of regenerative business. And you know, so they really analyze their whole you know, product line from start to finish and look at how they can make a positive impact. So yeah, for me regeneration is the way forward. Yeah,
awesome. So you're giving brands an opportunity to talk about what they're doing, but also this new project that we're going to talk about, This is an opportunity for you, like, to use this rebuilding of this old house, the tea, the farming in the rural areas, to bring people out from the city to do workshops and seminars, to use it as education, training, but also a wonderful base for doing your business. Is that right?
Right, exactly. So, you know, I think, you know, I've been helping brands and myself talk about all this change, you know, so I'm always talking, always lecturing and helping and supporting. But, you know, I really needed to start to make something more concrete and something more experiential. Because, you know, I always talk about this, you know, we've lost connection with ourselves, you know, we've lost connection with our society. And, you know, and I think nature is the ultimate tool to help us reconnect, you know. So, you know, I've always pushed, you know, different ideas of connecting with nature. But I wanted to go beyond that and create a space, create a project where people could come and experience nature. It's the best teacher, you know. We talk about biomimicry, learning from nature and through design. But, you know, so, and also, you know, the circular economy, it's all kind of based on natural models, you know. So if I can, you know, bring businessmen, salarymen from Tokyo, bring them to this beautiful space and, you know, help them see the natural cycles, it will help them to be inspired how to make their businesses better. So 12 years ago, it was like 5 years ago, I was, you know, I moved out to Fujino, which is it's a beautiful part of Kanagawa. And I was always looking for an old kominka to restore. I love kominkas. I've always had, you know, when I first came to Japan 18 years ago, I joined the Japan Kominka Restoration Association.
Yeah, that's amazing. I don't know many people that have joined the Japanese version. Right. Like I go to Minka Summit and that's all mostly international focused, but you went back to the original, Japanese people passionate about preserving old houses, right?
I guess back then, you know, there wasn't really the Gaijin community hadn't. Well, I mean, we've always been here and we've always loved old buildings, you know. I mean, we come to Japan because we love the old culture or sometimes manga and the new culture. But for me, it was all about the old culture. And so when I was here, I was just doing some research and I found the JMRA and a couple of my Japanese friends who are in the kind of natural building community introduced me to it, you know. But it was kind of tough. My Japanese was bad back then as well as it is now. So I was, you know, going on these Japanese outings, you know, once or twice a month we would go to visit a famous daiku. Yeah, there's one of the workshops we did, you know, so we would help people to restore kominka. That was a lovely old kura that was moved. So often they would do that as well. They would go and find a kura or a building that's about to be demolished, inspect it. And if it's a good example, they would all work together, bring it, you know, dismantle it, move it to another part of Japan and then rebuild it. So yeah, so I learned from the basics, you know, how to build walls, you know, how to make clay, you know, do this clay wall. So
plastering, yeah, as well as the foundation, yeah, of the wall.
Yeah,
that's
so
totally,
and actually all the way back then, I don't know if you know Kyle, I think he's mm-hmm. been.
Of course, yeah. So Kyle Holzhuter in Okayama, doing great stuff.
Great guy, you know, so back then, you know, he was just starting as well, and in fact, he came to one of my very early workshops that I was attending, you know, so that was the kind of roots of all the kind of modern kominka movement that we see now, and it's so wonderful to see. Yeah, the foreign community involved in it. So yeah, so I'd done this and I've always been helping other projects. So I wanted my own, you know, and I was actually looking at a house to buy and I saw this old building in the background and it wasn't for sale and it was all overgrown. And, you know, I just fell in love with it, but it took a couple of years just to find out who owned it. You know, so I eventually just went to the local government and you can check the registry. And I sent a mail letter off to the owner and eventually they replied and said, oh, they might be interested in selling. It was an old
man. You said it took about 2 years.
Yeah,
it was. We know that there is so many old houses which are abandoned. Yeah. But why does it take 2 years? How frustrating, because you mentioned in one of your videos that during that 2 year process of trying to get the house, it was deteriorating. There was water damage, right? What a shame.
This, you probably it was the opposite side of the house there, but the very back corner, there was a really bad leak. I mean, we went into the house and actually, yeah, so actually it's on the other side, so that's the good side. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so it's on the other side, but it really was so bad that, you know, the water was pouring in, you know, so we put up some blue sheets to try to rescue it. You know, I had a friend who's an architect came in to inspect it with me, and he fell through the tatami. You know, he just, there it is up there. So the corner, you can even see there's no wall. It's had, you know, the clay had deteriorated so badly in the top. And yeah, so it was really in bad situation, and I was desperate to start restoring it. And the story goes on, because it took 2 years to buy it, and that was because it's a family home, you know, so it's got traditions. So, you know, it gets passed down, and the young man who inherited it, you know, he kind of sees it as a liability, you know, but he didn't want to, he wanted to protect his family heritage. So he was very slow to sell. But there was a lot wrong with the property. So first of all, yeah, I mean, if anybody checked it, they would say, no, you need to demolish it. It's gone too far. But, you know, so he realized, yeah, he needed to sell. So eventually he sold it to me. So it was really a 2 year process. But then we've also got a grant application that's going to help us to fix it. But it's a long story. You know, we're very appreciative of the grant, but we got awarded last July. And once they award you, the clock starts ticking. You've got a year to finish the project. But they say you're not allowed to start building until they do the final approval of the paperwork. We still haven't got final approval. That was last July, and we have to finish this July. So we're in a tight spot, you know. So sometimes these grants are a blessing, but sometimes they just, you know, they're really trouble. So yeah, but in the meantime, we've taken the whole house down, you know. It's been,
beam by beam, right?
120-year-old building, and, you know, it's a silk farm, so it's not a very refined structure. So, you know, the building had sunk on different sides, so the whole building was warped. You know, it had the back, you know, so some of the beams had split because the whole building had warped. So we had, look at it. You know, I always say it was like a cabbie museum, because there's mold, there was mushrooms growing out of it. If you look at the bottom of these poles, I don't know how it was still standing. But, you know, I like a challenge, and it's definitely a case of, you know, be careful what you wish for. So I was like, you know, it's still beautiful. I want to rescue this, you know. Back in home in Ireland, we love old buildings, you know. It's kind of
everybody's
dream.
Most of the world loves old buildings, right? Yeah, I think Japanese people do too at the core. If you talk about the value of craftsmanship, the value of, you know, the way that these houses were made, the community of it. We can bring it back in Japan too, but the last 50 years has been this, oh, old houses are dark and dirty, and who wants to live in them, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, you know, contradiction, you know, because, you know, Japan love their tradition and their history. And of course, you know, if you ask anybody, they would say, yes, we need to protect these houses. But if they have one that's inherited to them, you know, they have this bad opinion. Yes, you said it. They think they're too cold. They think they're dangerous for earthquakes and fires. And, you know, in the meantime, these have stood the test of time, and through every earthquake, they're fine, you know. So, yeah. So I hope to use this as like the ultimate case study of, you know, things are worth protecting, because it's really, you know, most people have kuminkas and need to work on them, but this is ridiculous. So, but I think that's part of my, you know, the story that I want to create here, that, yeah, everything's worth saving.
It's a really unique house in that it has remnants of how it was making silk. Exactly. So it has these areas that maybe boiling the worms make the silk, right? Yeah. And then you're surrounded by kind of abandoned tea farms. So you're trying to bring back the tea, bring back at least the parts of the house that show that silk heritage, right?
Exactly. So Fujino was, actually a very important area in Edo period. So they produce most of the tea and silk for Edo, Tokyo. So I have an abandoned tea farm beside it, and it's huge, you know. Yeah, that's exactly it from above. But, you know, it's been abandoned for at least 15 years or more. So the whole forest is like encroaching. And so I've got this battle. I'm in there every day cutting away, and it seems like I'm not getting anywhere. But actually, you know, I've been doing it now for over a year now, and finally, you know, it's starting to shape up. And, you know, I got my permaculture design certificate since I last spoke to you. And, you know, it's a wonderful, it's a science, you know, and they've really created a great system about, you know, how to, you know, regenerate agriculture and produce food. So I'm using
that in Japan.
So there, in fact, in Fujino, where this area is, there's the Permaculture Center of Japan. And it's run by Shidara-san, which is a wonderful guy. And he's very interesting, and he aligns with me because he loves permaculture, but he wants to do a Japanese style of it, because basically it's ancient wisdom. You know, we all used to do organic farming. You know, it's not some new trend. You know, it's just the way it always was. And we always used to work more with natural cycles and, you know, work with composting, etc. So, yeah. So for me, I also want to go deeper than permaculture and go more into traditional Japanese natural farming. And I don't know if you've read the book One Straw Revolution. You know, fantastic book, you know, so that's kind of a little bit of a Bible for me. And at first impressions, it looks like a lazy man's approach to farming. You know, it's all about kind of just letting things grow, throwing seeds into the grass, you know, but it's much more deeper than that. And you really need to have a deep understanding of your property and the farm and the cycles and work with it. But long term, it does create these kind of natural cycles that are easier to manage. So natural farming is just, you know, it's really such a blessing. And I hope to, you know, use this place. We call it Satoyama Labo. So it's going to be a place where we'll experiment with all these old farming techniques and teach people and use it as a tool.
In reference to One Straw Revolution, Fukuoka sensei, I was just at Thomas Kleffer's farm in Hiroshima, and he's been practicing no-till. Fukuoka sensei was his inspiration to come over to Japan originally, and he's been doing this farming technique for 15 years. Fantastic. And showing how it is very effective. You can do it without tilling the ground, right? So that's wonderful to hear that you were also inspired. Fukuoka sensei was such an interesting guy, right? Mm. That book is amazing, isn't it?
He's incredible. You know, he's such a rebel, you know, and very, you know, educated man. So a lot of these kind of natural farmers are more kind of self-taught or whatever, but he's, you know, he's got the science to back it up, you know, and he does it from a very research standpoint. So he compares modern farming to, you know, his natural farming and tests it and records it, you know. So he's such an inspiration, you know, and it just shows, you know, he spoke up against the, you know, the sort of big agricultural movements, and he's a real light in the darkness. So yeah, I really Absolutely. Hope to kind of introduce him.
Yeah.
And, so
I love that story of how he got kids in Japan to save their seeds from school lunches, and then he put them into clay balls, and then he shot them out of helicopters in Africa trying to help them grow food. I mean, just incredible. There's so many great stories. I remember reading One Straw Revolution when I was traveling around California, and I had so many other fellow hippies stop me and say, I read that too. That book is amazing.
It's very simple, you know, it's very easy to read. And yeah, I recommend it to everyone.
That's awesome.
Part of this property, sorry, you know, so 3/4 of it, the tea farm, et cetera, is actually agricultural land. So in Japan, you're not allowed to buy agricultural land unless you've got a Japanese farmer license, you know. And this is an ongoing problem of people buying kominka, because naturally, they usually have agricultural land attached to it. So I had to spend 3 years to get my Japanese farmer license, you know, and I'm not an academic.
And you got it? I got it. Amazing, Rick.
2 months ago. And it just means I'm now a new entrant farmer. So you have like a 2 year kind of, what would you say, trial to see if you can do it. So I have to plan what I'm growing, you know, and make projections of, you know, what I'm going to sell and et cetera, and then do it, you know. So, and the tea farm's going to take a while to renovate, but I will be selling hand-picked, you know, natural green tea. But I'm growing, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I'm growing potatoes as an Irishman in Japan. So you have to have
your staple too, right?
Yeah, and I'm growing danshaku, which is the most popular Japanese potato. And if I looked into the history of it, and it actually is the Irish cobbler potato, and then I thought, oh great, this is an Irish potato, this is such a great story. But it turns out that it was an Irish cobbler who lived in the States, and he was breeding potatoes, and he came up with this new species. But it's such a lovely story, and now we're growing Irish cobblers in Fujino, and I'm opening up a farmer's stall in Farmer's Market in Aoyama in the summer. So I'll see you there if you're around.
Wow, that's awesome. And I love your idea about there are modern tools that you can use to harvest the tea, but you were talking about the best tea in the world is handpicked.
Exactly.
And what a wonderful experience to bring people out to the farm, give them the chance to harvest the tea, process the tea, and then drink the tea. I love that. And of course, interplays beautifully sustainable business, but also sustainable tourism, right?
Exactly. You know, so, I mean, I'm not going to get into the business of selling tea. You know, that's not what we're about. We will do it. We're going to make our own package brand, but it's more of, again, the laboratory feeling. We're going to experiment and produce completely natural green tea. So in Japan, you know, like most farming, a lot of chemicals is used, you know, and even in the tea. I mean, a lot of the tea farms, they say they're not going to go for organic certification because they believe they're doing it in a different way. So there's not a lot of organic tea. So I'm going to let it grow completely wild. It's already wild. And I think it's beautiful. I want to see, you know, what tea trees could look like. And yeah, I mentioned it. I've done a lot of research in China. They grow a lot of really wild tea in the mountains. And it's actually the most exclusive, expensive teas. So, I mean, I'm just going to experiment and see, you know, and we're going to use like, you know, fertilizer from the mountain, which is just leaves. We're going, you know, and do everything completely naturally. And as you say, we're going to bring people out to do tea picking, and we're going to use a kind of mindful approach, you know, so do kind of Zen training. I'm going to bring Zen mindfulness into business, but picking tea, I think, is a very beautiful way to be mindful, you know, because it's very repetitive. Don't have to think too much, and there's tons of it, you know, so you can kind of really lose yourself. So yeah, that's the idea.
I love that. And whenever I do tours and take people through our beautiful gardens here in Hiroshima, and we get a chance to watch the gardeners, and you just see how they have that mindful approach to it. They're not listening to podcasts or radio. They're not even talking. They're just, it's like a meditative experience. I love that idea of introducing that to people who are visiting your tea farm.
Exactly. You know, so, you know, I've been studying a lot on this, you know, and I came across the Shinrin Yoku, which is the, you know, forest bathing. I don't know if you heard about that, but, you know, it's really been researched properly in Japan, and the government kind of confirmed that forest bathing is as good for you as antidepressants. In fact, better. And they've clinically trialed it with, you know, samples of people on antidepressants, and the rest of them, they would bring on these forest therapy trips. And the people that were in the forest had way better responses, you know, and it's something we all feel and know, but to see it being clinically proven is amazing, you know. So all this principles we'll be teaching at the mill, and, you know, getting people just, I mean, look at the green mountain behind it. It's just being there is healing.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the process. Can you run us through how did you find this house? How did you think that this house was the one for you to do this project?
So as I mentioned, I was actually looking for a house for a long time. And for Gino, you know, you always hear about these free houses and, it's a bit of a pipe dream, you know, because if the area is popular, there's no way you can find free houses, you know. And in Fujino, you know, everyone loves Cominkas and there's a few, but they're like as soon as they go on the market, they get bought up. And there's also kind of local networks, so you'll never find out about them unless you're there, you know. So I lived there for a few years and, you know, made friends with the local kind of leaders of the community. And, you know, but still, this was just totally serendipitous. You know, we were looking at a house in front of it, you know, a little bit further away. And I just spied this in the background. And I mean, at the beginning, I wanted it to be a home, you know, so somewhere to live in. But it's just the whole over the years now, because it's been like 4 years since I got it. It's turning more into kind of a business. You know? Well, not, you know, or like a kind of like a workshop space, you know, so I won't be living in it anymore. And, you know, in the second floor, we're going to have cubicles. So people, you know, like breakout rooms, the ground floor is just, yeah, the top floor is very small. So we'll be doing this kind of little, we'll have a little space at the top. But it's kind of complicated with a building permission, you know. So even though it has three floors, officially you're not allowed to have three floors. So, and if it becomes, if you re-registered as a three-floor building, it goes into a whole different safety and tax bracket. So it turns out that I won't be able to do that top floor into a bedroom. It's going to be more of a space for drying tea. So, you know, we're going to make sand and bancha. So part of that process is hanging the branches in the trees. So the top floor is going to be more just a processing area. Second floor would be breakout rooms. We're also going to have an editing room. So, you know, so it's going to be more of a space to create content. You know, we're going to be doing an online, these kind of little spaces for working in. So it's kind of, you know, like community cafe as well. So people can come and work remotely there. And, you know, if an artist wants to come and write their book or do some, you know, so it's going to be a space just for creation. And the ground floor, we're going to have a tea room. So in the corner, we're going to make a proper tea room. And I've been studying Sado. I have an amazing master in, you know, he lives in Tokyo, and he's a Senno Riku great, great, great grandson. So he's also kind of helping consulting on making sure the tea room, you know, is properly laid out. So it went from a home to more of a regenerative learning center, you know, and I'm just much more excited now to make it into a space for change making.
That's awesome. Little shout out to some people joining us live. It looks like Carl on YouTube and John on LinkedIn. Great to have you guys here. Go Rick, good luck with your Cominka adventure and tea farm. Hospital gardens also a good strategy for health, relaxation, mental healing. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Totally, you know,
now so. you had some challenges, it sounds like, to find a carpenter to work with you a lot at first, which everyone who buys an old house has the same feeling of frustration, because at first everyone's like, just tear it down. Yeah. Why are you spending so much time? It's worthless. But finding someone who values the old houses, willing to work with you, you found a great architect carpenter, right?
Yeah, so at times now, I thought, yeah, maybe they were right. But no, I mean, it's going to be worth it in the end. So, yeah. So this is Osawa Sensei, and he's actually the founder of the JMRA, the Japan Cominka Restoration Association. So he was my sensei back in the day when I did Cominka Gakko for the year. And we've been keeping in touch. And, you know, so I asked him to come out and have a look at this. And he instantly could see the potential and loved it. And, you know, so he's very positive and, you know, and he's seen so many projects. So he's seen, you know, in Japan, actually, you know, if you have at least one pillar standing, you can still repair and renovate the house, you know. So at least half of our house was okay. So he saw the potential and he did a whole survey with me. But yeah, I was inviting, first of all, local daikus to come check it out and small building companies. And everyone would just shake their head and go, look, you know, you're crazy. Tear it down. It'll be way cheaper and better. And I was going, no, I want to protect this thing. And, you know, and it's not the best example of a kominka. I love it. But it's only 120 years old. And by then it started to make the pillars, you know, they got thinner and thinner. You know, they got more, you know, the old kominkas were over-engineered. So you can tell kind of, but yeah, you can see the thickness of the pillars. But this is it now. And we've totally, you know, like the right side's almost completely new. And we reinforced the roof and you can see the joins. And we got an amazing daiku called Kondo-san. And he's been so understanding and helpful and also excited about the project. You know, he saw it as a real challenge and he went, yes, this is going to be the best project of my life. Because every now and again, I ask him, are you okay? You know, is this too much? And he goes, no, this is just such a great opportunity.
That's and he's so a young awesome guy. To hear. And yeah. You were talking about sourcing the material. So it looks like you're using some of the original wood. You're trying to reuse or recycle as much as possible. But if you're using new, you're trying to source locally, which also helps. We need more thinning of the forests in Japan. And yes. Then it looks like you're also doing yakisugi technique, burning the cedar, right?
Totally. So yeah, so you know, I really want this to be a kind of, you know, like a low carbon project, you know, recycle, reuse, repair. And you know, and I'm, you know, I'm always kind of going back and forth with my daiku, you know, because I'm trying to rescue things that are maybe too far gone, you know. So it's been a kind of a learning curve. And he's going, look, you know, you know, why are you so obsessed with not using new wood, you know? And I'm going, yeah, but, you know, I don't want to cut down trees. And of course, the sugi issue is such a big problem here, you know, and especially around this area, you know, when the pollen season is out, you know, you just see these clouds of pollen. And the forests are like, you know, they're man-made and they're kind of unsustainable. You know, they're not well-planted. They're dangerous. We have landslides. They're kind of dead forests, you know, because they're too tightly packed. So there's no diversity and, you know, there's no food for animals. So we're working with local wood dealer who sources locally. So we're making sure, you know, it's coming from areas that, you know, we're having a good impact. And yeah, I get obsessed with not touching nature, but this has been a cycle of life all through time, you know, and we have wooden products everywhere. So as long as it's ethically and sustainably sourced, it's okay. It's even good sometimes, you know.
So. Absolutely. I went to Minka Khan last year and we went out to see how agricultural organization is trying to use the wood and then plant more diverse forests, which is more natural, more healthy, but also some of the wood maybe on the outside was not as beautiful. So they were doing yakisugi, burning the wood, which makes it beautiful, actually insulates, make it more fireproof, but also it covers any blemish. So it looks beautiful, right?
Yeah, exactly. So at the minute, you know, there's such a contrast, you know, it's black and white with the new wood. And I kind of like it, you know, but I'm not going to keep it like that, you know. So I'm going to use the, you know, persimmon oil. It's the fermented persimmon. And, you know, it's kind of reddish, you know, and they use it a lot for preserving wood. So it's a traditional wood persimmon, you know, but I find a great company and actually mixes it with sumi. And actually, you can also put iron nails into it and it reacts and goes black. So we're kind of going to paint all the beams with that. So not only does it preserve it, but it also makes it match the darker wood. And on the outside, we're doing the yakisugi. So the yakisugi, I wanted to do it on the inside, but it's a bit messy. And, you know, you have to then, you know, seal it and everything. So we're just going to use that persimmon finish.
I love it. It's going to have such a beautiful modern but traditional combination kind of architecture and look. I can't wait to see the finished product. What's your idea for reusing these old silk traditional places. How are you going to reuse that? Yeah.
So there was three of them in there. So one was a modern one, which the guy was using for cooking. And then there was two older ones. So one of the older ones was like the size of a tatami mat, so very big. And I really wanted to keep it exactly the way it is, but we're building around it, and it was actually made just from clay, local clay and stones. So as I tried, I had to take it down to move it, but it just collapsed into dust. So we're going to rebuild it, and we kept the stones. So we've kind of fixed the foundations, we've, building the floors, and actually next week I'm going to start rebuilding it. So using the original stones and clay and sand, it's actually quite easy to make. So I'm going to rebuild that, and it'll be a nice feature, so it's going to be a wooden floor with this irori in the middle, and it's going to be a kind of nice central space to kind of cook and have a social area. So definitely keeping it as a nod to the past. Yeah.
Sounds amazing. I thought at first, before I saw your description, I thought it was, like some of the traditional kitchens, they have the underfloor as kind of an old style cooler, because it's cooler under the floor and to keep drinks and things. I wonder if it has that same function, if it keeps things cooler.
Right. So this was only for fire, so they had built it up, and it had like all ashes from so many years, and it was too high. So yeah, but that's something I want to build, is actually, because I'm going to be making these vegetables, etc., and we're going to build like a cellar, a root cellar, just to keep them. But yeah, there wasn't anything like that on the property. It was very functional. Yes, the guy lived there, but it was completely dedicated to silk farming. The top floor was just slatted wood. So there were, they would lay the mulberry leaves there and let the silkworms feed on that. So it was really very functional building. Yeah, so there's the guy in the very top window there. That's the small area. So that's top floor was just for laying out leaves. The story unfortunately has been lost a little bit. I've been trying to find somebody who could tell me the history, but the nephew who inherited it, he just, all he could tell me was he was just so shocked when he would visit his uncle, because he lived so old school, he got water from the mountain. So that's actually one of the beautiful things. I've got running water from the mountain access. So, yeah.
That's lovely. And you also talked about doing a compost toilet. Tell us about that. That's a way to live off grid, right?
So again, I'm coming up against regulations a lot. And, if you want to have a kind of business that has public visiting, you're not allowed to have compost toilets. it's one of those tricky situations where, if there was an existing compost toilet, you can get away with it. But if you want to build, you're not allowed, So I've been, trying to find solutions. Lixil is one of my clients. They're, the very big housing company, and they're experimenting with, toilets and creating these off-grid toilets. And even they are having problems. They've created the technology to make these toilets that are self-sustaining. You literally, at the end of the month, it makes these blocks of compost through the toilet system. It's free of, the heat system inside. But even though they've made this great technology, you can use it's totally inert, non-smelling, compost at the end. You can put it in your garden. It's illegal in Japan, So yeah, so they're working on a very high level to try and get government to change these, because they're based on health and safety, but they're so broad that they're very limiting. So long story, but so we're just going to put in kind of low energy toilets. We're going to do a Jokusho, which is and the one I find is actually very good. It kind of treats the water, and the water becomes, you can release the water back into the environment very easily. So it's a high tech solution. And I probably will build a compost toilet for myself on the farm, you know, just to kind of show the laboratory style. I got really obsessed with, they call it humanure. And there's a really good book called The Humanure Handbook, you know, and it studies all the old systems on how to create toilets. And it's fascinating stuff. My 10-year-old son got very obsessed with it, you know. Toilets.
It is. It's once you realize they can work without water. Yeah. And they can go more naturally back to nature. Yeah. And this was what indigenous cultures around the world were doing, including Japan. It's crazy. We have a kind of a national reserve area that has compost toilets here, and that's definitely for the public. So I don't know about that rule. That's a bit strange, right?
It's also regional, and right. You know, there's different rules, but and there's a lot of contradictions, you know, yeah. And you know, and it's kind of like, you know, asking for forgiveness is easier than asking for permission. But because I'm going to make it into a cafe as well, right, on the ground, yeah, floor. And
but the, you know, technical solution, that sounds like a good compromise.
Exactly. You right? know, so it's low energy toilets. And, you know, that's what this is about. You know, we want to use ancient wisdom, but also mix it. And we're got, you know, the far side of the roof, the sun facing is going to be one huge solar array. So it's going to be one big black solar panel. So that's going to be enough energy for everything, because we're going to have like editing facilities, making films, etc. there, and kitchen. So it's all going to be off grid. You know, we're going to use water collection from the roof, and we're going to build a big cistern beside the, you know, so we're going to reuse rainwater, etc. So we're going to be off grid, but then use new technology at the same time, you know. So because I'm not against new ways, and in fact ancient wisdom's not about giving up luxury and, you know, being a hippie and, you know, getting dirty and uncomfortable, you know. It's about a balance of using the best of both worlds, and that's
absolutely beautiful, you know? You can keep the relevance but bring it into modern relevance, right? Exactly. Keep the traditions, keep the design, preserve, like what you're doing by rebuilding the traditional way, you're also giving the artisans a chance to pass on that knowledge. Exactly. To future generations. There's so much you're doing which is so valuable and so great. And when you come up against these hurdles, you know, it sounds like you've got a great strategy. You're like, well, what can we do, right? Yeah. And that's sustainable business. That's absolutely how you do it. You take what are the options, what can we do, and then reassess over time, right?
Exactly. And I think that's one of the issues in Japan. You know, they're always looking for a perfect solution and, you know, very risk aversion, you know, so that's why there's not a lot of change. So even with a broken system, they prefer to keep it than to change and make a mistake, you know. So we got to kind of make these mistakes, you know, and it's like two steps forward, one back. We're still making progress, you know, so. Yeah,
I love it. I've recently been thinking a lot about gray water, the idea of reusing, yeah, like your bath water or, yeah, your kitchen water. Do you have a system for that? Are you reusing the water from the house?
So I have so many plans, and we're gonna have to phase it. I just realized, you know, it's impossible to do everything at once, you know, and I made a grand plan, and, you know, I've got, you know, gray water treatment systems, making reed beds and, you know, filtering the water through it and having pipes out into the field. And we will do that in the future. And actually I'm going to kind of do it more like workshops so we can kind of all learn together. You know, invite in experts and, you know, like people like Kyle, you know, can come in and help us do plastering. And, you know, so yeah, you know, again, it's just one of the things that I've had to put on the back burner for now and just focus on getting the house finished, you know. So, and we're doing minor upgrades. So for instance, you talk about people think kominkas are cold, and yes, in traditional living, you know, we really lived in harmony with the seasons, you know, and we huddled around the ibori and wore clothes. But, you know, in modern living, you know, that's a bit of a sacrifice. So we're putting natural insulation into the walls. So we're building a cavity, and we're, you know, at the minute we're still trying to solve exactly what we're going to put into it, but we wanted to use rice husk as an insulating cavity, which is unusual. It's more done in Southeastern Asian countries, but I mean, we've got all this rice waste hair husk, and we can mix it with lime and then fill it into the cavity. And it's a fantastic insulation layer, natural, breathable, fire resistant, insect resistant. So these kind of little improvements are still building on that wisdom. So yeah, so that's the kind of thing we're focusing on at the minute, but toilets definitely later. And so it's basically just putting gray water into a reed bed system. I don't know if you've researched it yourself, you know. So it's a natural treatment, and you have it filtering down through the reed beds, through different layers of sand and stones, and then eventually into a kind of water, you know, aqua system, you know, where you can have fish, etc. in it. So creating these kind of loops, I love it. And we're going to be doing more of that in the future, definitely.
That's awesome. We've got some great comments. BBB says, love to hear of these kominka being reused as modern life, modern business things. Wonderful. Thanks for joining. And we have, hello, Japanese here. They always seek for a perfect solution. Exactly. LOL.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, you know. I mean, it's part of what makes Japan fantastic. You know, they really, you know, refine things to perfection, and you know, and just keep working and working on something, you know. But you know, and it, you know, with regards to these kind of architecture and buildings, that's a result of that never-ending small improvements. Call it ringe, you know. So, and it's wonderful part of the culture, but you know, it also. You know, kind of holds back innovation a little bit, you know, like, you know, you look at it with EV cars, etc., just that resistance to, you know, innovation, and, you know, and it's allowing other countries to kind of take the lead. So a little bit of balance would be great, you know.
Well, speaking of EVs, that would be a wonderful thing for you to have with your solar panels. Are you also looking at batteries, like a battery for the place to have backed up?
Yeah, so that's a huge solar array, and it's actually very future-proof. You know, it's a big house, you know, and it's more of a design feature as well. I don't want just a little group of solar panels. I want to make it all big one black roof. So we will need a battery system for sure, and we're going to be putting that in. And again, we're just looking at Chinese solutions because they really have taken the lead, and they have very, very high quality, very efficient, you know, systems now. You know, I have, you know, SunPower or Maxeon's one of my clients, and they're a US brand, used to be the leaders in solar, but the Chinese are just taking over. So we're going to put Chinese panels in, you know. And yeah, so
there's a lot of Japanese businesses, you know, including Honda and the solar companies that are collaborating with Chinese companies. Totally. I'm putting more solar and a battery in, and we're using Japanese companies as well. And I just bought a Honda all electric, and the Honda new electric car can act as a battery in case of an emergency. So you can feed it back into the house. So there's technology in old houses, you know, it really does go well together, right? Yeah.
I wrote an article actually because, you know, I feel guilty that I have a Jimny, a 4x4 petrol car, and I'm going around talking to everyone about sustainability. And I felt really guilty about it. So I decided to write an article about it. So I published it just to kind of show my stance, you know. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the like the right way is not, doesn't work for you. So for instance, I like 4x4ing. I don't know if I told you a story. When I left South Africa, I bought a 4x4 and I drove from Cape Town to Cairo. So all the way, 9 months driving through jungles, and there just isn't an EV out there that can do that. Maybe the Cybertruck, but that's another story, you know. And I don't even have it here, and it's too big. You know, it's the totally wrong philosophy. I want something small, lightweight, you know, very utilitarian, 4x4 capable, because I take my son and we go into the mountains and we camp. And so I, you know, where possible, I ride my bicycle in Tokyo. So I reduce my dependence on the petrol car, but I use it for a purpose, you know. And it's, you know, and I wanted
Ian,
to say
Ian Davey at the Minka Summit, and I got some video on the channel here, talking about reusing like tempura oil and creating biodiesel from used oil. So if you have a petrol car, that might be an option too, but it takes a bit of, you got to regenerate, you got to get a mechanic to change your engine. So it's not something you can do right away.
No,
right?
So, you know, so the will is there, but, you know, the finances perhaps not. You know, I was also looking at possibly putting an EV conversion into it, which you can do, but it's super expensive. And, you know, I'm just waiting for the Japanese to finally...
Adopt. Well, this is the year. Japan is finally coming out with Japanese car makers are finally coming out with electric cars. So this is the year. It shouldn't be too much longer.
And not only that, you know, like in Tokyo, it's parking is such a problem. And I had to find parking, and it's not beside my apartment. So, you know, even if you want to charge, you know, it's like difficult, you know. So I ranted in my little article just to kind of try to make myself better. But I think it's important to acknowledge things and not don't have to be perfect. You just have to do your best and try to reduce your impact. And there's many ways to do that than just being completely 100% perfect.
Absolutely. And that's the whole idea, right? You do what you can, but don't let the fact that you can't do things perfectly stop you from getting started, right?
Because that's what's happening. You know, because there is no perfect solution, people are not moving. So just do things imperfectly and just start getting ahead, you know. That's what we
need. Absolutely. Yeah. We only have about less than 10 minutes now. What haven't we talked about with this project or other projects you're working on that you want to talk about?
So the mill, you know, it's still at very early days. We hope to have first courses at the end of summer. And as part of this grants system, we need to get that in place. But in Tokyo, we started a kind of workshop series called Sato Labo. And we have a beautiful studio in Shinjuku, Gyoen Mai, and it's very big. And so we do workshops there. And the first one we did was called, Pollinator Pit Stops, you know. And it's all about creating little pollinator pit stops for bees. Bee populations are collapsing all over the world, you know. In Fujino here, I have a lot of beekeeper friends, native species. And the last 2 years, there hasn't been any bees around. It's very worrying, you know. So obviously climate change is a big factor, the heat. Bees are very sensitive to heat, but also pesticides and fertilizer. But so in the Tokyo city, you know, bees, they can't fly very far. They use a lot of energy. And when it's hotter, they can't fly as far. So they can see flowers from 100 meters away. So if we all grew some flowers, put them on our balcony, and made these kind of little bee corridors in the city, we can literally have a massive impact, you know. So for me, it's a really good example of a small action can lead to a big movement. So we're doing these kind of workshops to try to get people to make small actions in the city. Because, you know, we talk about compost, you know, and everyone thinks you have to be a farmer, you have to have big land. But actually, you know, with Bokashi composters in the home, you can recycle your own, you know, kitchen waste and make nice fertilizer. And we did a collaboration with, you know, LFC. So they're a compost bag maker, and they make these beautiful oshare bags that you can keep in the kitchen, and they zip up and you can make compost from them. But the problem is, you can make all this compost in your house, but what do you do with it? You know, you've only got a few house plants. If you're lucky, you've got a garden, but still the amount of consumption we do. So they're creating a network of urban farms. I don't know if you know John, the urban farmer. So he's a great example. So you can kind of, you know, bring your compost to these kind of people and let them use it, and they can give you a discount on veggies. So again, it's creating these little loops. So Sato Labo is all about, you know, in the city, how we can make change. And we're kind of brainwashing people into being sustainable. And then we send them to the mill for the next level of high level training. So that's something we've been doing as well.
I love it because, you know, with so many people, whenever I talk to you guys, always doing these such inspiring projects, but it's also the way you want to live your life.
Yes.
And I think you're introducing this joy of living more sustainably, that it makes you feel good about how you're living your life and choices, right?
That's a brilliant point. You know, a lot of people think choosing an ethical or sustainable life is all about sacrifice, you know, giving up what you like to eat, you know, not wearing this fast fashion, paying more, you know, but actually it's the opposite. You know, it's regaining this passion for life, for food, you know, making your own miso, making your own compost, you know, touching the soil. It's so much fun. And, you know, it's just, you know, it leads to a much more passion-filled life. You know, it's not about sacrifice. And that's what I want to teach as well. You know, there's a lot of groups out there that kind of push in a very aggressive way. You know, you need to give up this. You shouldn't be eating that. You know, I'm vegan, but I don't push it on anybody. And I always say I'm 99% vegan because I will cheat with a pizza slice or sneak an ice cream in the summer. You know, I'm not perfect, but that's fine. You know, you don't need to be, as long as you can reduce your life and be happy is the most important thing.
Absolutely. And I love how you're just applying all these principles that you established your business on to give businesses the opportunity to explain their brand and how they can have a better brand by being more sustainable. And now you're introducing how you're trying to recreate this house and all the frustration, but there are things you can do which are better than normal, right? And so that's so inspiring. Thank you for all you're doing.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. I mean, it's not an easy path. And actually, I don't have time to maybe explain it, but
oh no!
I cut my finger, but making sanem bancha, which is chopping up the old branches of trees. But you know, anyway, it's all good. It's healing.
That happens, yeah. Oh dear, when you're learning these things, there's a lot of mistakes that can happen, right?
And I've learned a lot, you know, because I'm rushing things, you know, because I'm still in a Tokyo business mindset. You know, I got to get things done. You know, I got to, you know, make impact quickly. And I'm rushing, you know, I'm rushing this house with the grants. I'm rushing the tea. And I've got a lot to learn still that I, you know, I need to slow down my own life and practice what I preach. Otherwise, accidents happen and it's, you know, it's not sustainable.
Well, if people want to learn more, what's the best place for them to follow your journey and to come and visit this project and help fund it? Are you doing crowdfunding or anything?
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. I've just launched a crowdfunding platform because, you know, every time we open up a wall, every time we do anything, the costs are spiraling. And I'm making tough choices as well. I'm trying not to use plastic or concrete, and all these things makes it cheaper, you know? So everything to do it properly is just adding on the cost. So we're looking for support. So we have a crowdfunding page. But not only that, the crowdfunding for us is more about starting the community, because it's all about creating a community that's interested in these things. So we have like good rewards where you can have free courses and, you know, become part of the whole community, because that's what it's all about. You know, we want to make a community of change makers. They'll come to this space and we'll all learn together and then go back to the city and spread the good news, you know. So we have a crowdfunding. Our Instagram's is probably the most active. So we have my personal account, Rick Rehan, but we have Image Mill, but we've started Mill Sato Labo. And that's going to be dedicated to the Mill project. So everything's on there and we're posting very regularly. And that's one of the good things that we have a production company. So we're producing content.
You're pretty good at marketing and branding in a very sustainable way. So that works to your benefit when you do things like crowdfunding and new projects, right?
Well, I would have thought so, but the crowdfunding's going super slow.
Oh, no. Okay, well, we will put all the links below and try to promote what great work you're doing. So thank you so much, Rick, for sharing all your insights. It's always nice to chat with you and catch up.
Too. Yeah, thanks for inviting back, and you know, keep up the great work, following you all the time. You know, you're lasting the test of time, so it's fantastic.
How? Like, it's a surprise always, right? But I'm always so grateful for people willing to come on as guests and share what you're doing. I know everybody's so busy. It sounds like you're super busy. Try to take some downtime. Indeed. And try to, you know, keep your balance as much as possible.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining. Thank you so much, Rick. And we'll see you again next time. Take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.